Okay, sorry I'm a little bit late. I hope I don't lose my voice in the middle of this. So today I want to tell you about usability and how that impacts the software engineering process. Usability is a really critical part of designing good software, and it can make the difference between your piece of software actually being used on a long-term basis or not used. And I'm sure you've all had experiences with software that has badly designed interfaces and isn't that usable. So we're going to go through some of the issues that are involved in this. There we go. Okay. What I might do if I can control this. So Perdita Stevens, who used to give this course, made this statement about engineering. It's managing the tension between the constraints of the mathematical universe and the flexibility of human intelligence. And this applies particularly to the usability question, where the sort of the mathematical universe that we're dealing with is the piece of software, which does obey laws of logic and mathematics and so on. And the user at the other end has all the flexibility that we know about. And getting those two sort of things to work together is the job of interface design. So if you're developing software that has a user interface, or you're developing the component of software that has an interface to people, then you have to obviously pay attention to usability. You might think that if you're developing software that isn't going to have an interface to the users, that you don't need to worry about it. But even if you're developing a component that isn't involved in the actual user interface, the chances are it's going to be used by other programmers, other humans. So many of the same issues that you have to deal with in making your component easily usable by those programmers are similar to the issues that you have to deal with in making the whole piece of software usable by non-programmer users, typically non-programmers. So what's the problem here? Well, lots of software people end up saying this is hard to use, despite effort having gone into making it not the case. And lots of problems are described particularly by software engineers, as user errors or loser errors in many cases. It's one of the sort of maxims we have in the, or at least I have in the software company I'm associated with, is never underestimate the stupidity of users. If they can do something stupid, they will. So it of course, in the end, if they're doing something stupid and you don't take care of that, you don't give them an appropriate error message, or you don't handle their stupidity in some way, then really you haven't done a good enough job of providing them with software that they consider usable. So it's a very hard problem. You're trying to cope with the kind of random things that people might do. So most of these things that are talked of as user errors are actually interface design failures. And so let's look at why this happens. Part of it is, a good part of it is limitations that people have. So one of the things is that we don't have very good short-term memories. We only remember five to seven things. Actually, it's five plus or minus two. So as you get older, it gets less. But it's a very small number. So you can't expect the users to be remembering what they had on the screen, 15 screens ago, or even maybe two screens ago. So that's one of the limitations you have to cope with. People make mistakes. Even if they know what the right thing to do is, they may sometimes click the wrong button, especially if they're under stress, especially if they're older in some way. I mean, just as an example of this, my 88-year-old mother is trying to get to grips with an iPhone. And, the iPhone user interface, I mean, if there's one device out there that has an easy-to-use user interface, it's an iPhone, right? iOS is just great. It's really intuitive. And, yesterday I called her on her mobile phone because I'm trying to give her practice with using this thing. and she goes to press the answer, you know, thing that you tap on answer, and she taps something else by mistake. And that was that, you know, there was no chance of getting through to her. So even an iPhone, you know, is challenging for some people. Another aspect of this is that people have very widely varying capabilities, and you know, mostly we think of that as mental capabilities. So some people will pick up an interface much faster than other people, but they also have different physical capabilities. So you know, some people may be trying to interact with your software through a text-to-speech device because they're blind. Many people will be colorblind. So there are all sorts of different capabilities that people have. People have very different preferences, and lots of software tries to cope with that by allowing you to customize, to have some preferences that you can set. And one of the most important things is that people, we all organize the world. We have a sort of model of the world. We have a model of the way things work. And people build different models. So people have an understanding of how the world works that's different. And that extends to your piece of software. There's another example from my my software company. The CEO is one of the most computer illiterate people I've ever met. And he's CEO of a software company, but he's brilliant business-wise. So actually, he's one of our best testers because, you know, if he can, we figure if he can learn how to use this bit of software, then you know we've cracked it. And you know, I've spent quite a bit of time actually trying to understand what his mental model is of what's going on behind the software, because I know exactly what's going on behind it, and it just doesn't make any sense to me. So people are very different, and you have to understand that. And when you come at this from a software engineering background and you're talking to other software engineers, it's very easy to forget that people are not thinking about information the way you think about it. You know, you've gone through a whole degree about to do with information processing, and you know, you think about the world to some extent in terms of information. But a lot of people don't, because they've never been exposed to that. So that's an aspect. So there are a number of principles of user interface design that we're going to go. So we'll go through these now in a little bit of detail for each one. So user familiarity, consistency, minimal surprise, recoverability, user guidance, and user diversity. You can imagine what these are, but we'll go through each one in turn. If you want to see more detail on any of them, Somerville's book, chapter 16, has a lot more on each of them. So familiarity. So the interface should look familiar to users. And that means that it should use concepts and entities that they understand. So if it's a piece of software that is, for example, dealing with managing books in a library, which we've used as an example, then it needs to have the concepts of borrowing, and it needs to have the concept of book, and you know, it's fairly obvious what it needs to have. But that applies to any piece of software. You know, you have to think about what is the domain that it's going to be used in, what are the concepts people are going to bring to that. And again, another example from the company that I work with, when we first produced our electronic lab notebook, we didn't have a particularly clear idea of which kind of scientists would want it. We knew it was targeted at scientists, but we didn't have a particularly clear idea of which kind. And you know, it turns out that biologists and physicists and chemists do quite different things, even though they're all working in labs, and they have different kinds of concepts. And we tried to create a piece of software that would cater to all of them, and found that if you try to be that general, it's very difficult to support people in the specific things they want, because you can't build in specific concepts that they understand. So you know, this is a challenge for software that is targeted at a wide audience. So if you think of, for example, an air traffic control system, you know, that's going to need concepts of things like aircraft, height, speeds, that, you know, weather, that sort of thing. It doesn't need to have concepts of a database or any of that. You know, the user doesn't care what's behind it. And familiarity is the main philosophy behind the desktop metaphors on PCs. So, you know, that also shows some of the limits. So we talk about a file on a PC, but it's not like a file in a filing cabinet. And, you know, some people who are, especially older people who are used to dealing with things like filing cabinets, think of that a file in a PC is like a file in a filing cabinet. And it's not the same thing, it's just conceptually similar. So that's another problem that you find, is that if you introduce a term in your user interface, then people will bring to that whatever their background makes that term mean. And again, we had a problem with this. One of the things that our notebook allows people to do is to design different structures of information that they can record. So they might want to record one kind of experiment with certain pieces of data, another kind of experiment with certain other kinds of pieces of data, and we want to give those two things names. Well, if you're a programmer, you'd call those things classes, right? Because they're different classes of information, and every instance of that, you know, is one copy of that class. So we called them classes because it's sort of the obvious thing to do. But it turns out that, you know, most people don't understand what that means, of course, because they're not programmers. And it's actually been quite hard to come up with a term that a lot of people understand. We tried form. Some people like form, but then they think of web forms, and it's not exactly the same thing as a web form. Other people liked templates, and that's what we've ended up with, is the word template. But it's not ideal. So people bring their own interpretation to these concepts. So consistency. So similar operations should be represented in similar ways, and you have to think about, you know, how far are you going to take that? Is that across across the single application? Is it across all applications on this particular machine? And if you think about the different kind of operating systems that you deal with, so Windows and Apple's operating systems try to be quite consistent. And I think that iOS, the Apple operating system that runs on the iPads as well, and I think is pretty soon going to be running on all the Apple machines, is particularly the touch devices. They've put a lot of effort into making sure that it's a consistent interface. And that's why people find the iPhone so easy to use, is because that, you know, they learn a few things and it applies to all the other apps, or most of the other apps. And they, you know, Apple maintain that by having very tight control over the apps. So you can't just put in, unlike for Android, for iOS, you can't just, you know, distribute an app. It has to go through the App Store, Apple have to approve it, and you better meet their standards. As you know, Unix doesn't really worry too much about this kind of consistency, and that's why lots of people find Unix not very easy to use. But some, you know, some distributions are, you know, try to be more consistent than others. So, like Ubuntu, for example, is, I think, quite a good good example of one that tries to be a bit more consistent. And you know, the question of what similarity means: does it mean that delete means the same thing wherever you see it? That's, you know, it depends on the applications you're dealing with. Does it mean that the delete button always appears in the same place? So iOS is a good example of that. You know, if you want to navigate back to the previous screen, the place you touch is almost always at the top left. So you just, you know, you just very quickly learn that's where you go if you want to go back. So consistency is an important principle. Minimal surprise. So you don't want to get into the situation where the user is surprised by the behavior of the system. You don't want to get to the point where they say, you know, what was that? Why did that happen? And I'm sure you've all experienced that. That's quite often caused by what are called modal applications, which you may know this term. But it basically means that the same key or the same mouse click may have different effects in different modes. So for example, as you'll know for Windows, you know, a right mouse click will often get you a menu of choices of something that you can do right there. And that's sort of a consistently applied. So one thing you could sort of think about is, you know, when was the last time you were surprised by a computer? And you know, how could the application have avoided surprising you? Has anybody got any gems for us about, you know, some computer that did something just was really stupid recently? No? Okay. Sometimes people do. Okay, recoverability. So this is really important because the users are going to make mistakes. You are going to sometimes surprise the user. It's unavoidable. So it needs to be easy for the user to recover. And you know, it used to be the case that even editors might not have had undo commands. And actually, if you've ever had to implement undo in a system, it's one of the hardest features to implement. You can do it in a sort of brute force kind of way by at every stage you save everything so that you can then just go back. But that chews up either memory or disk. If you're putting it in disk, then you're going to take a long time to get that state back. So you end up having to have a complex representation of what the user has done so that you can go back, depending on the system. But typically undo is something that people really would like to stay away from, but you can't. So one thing you can try is getting confirmation of irrevocable action, so ones that you can't undo. And of course there are times when, you know, you have to do that. You can't always have an undo. If something's been deleted off the disk, then it's pretty much gone. But the problem with this kind of confirmation is that, you know, it's like confirmation that you've read the Twitter's privacy rule. You know, people just click OK, and they learn to just click OK very quickly, and nobody, you know, they don't. So it's a very limited utility, really. Mostly, it sort of protects the developers and the company from any comeback, like Twitter had recently with the releasing data. So checkpointing and or auto-saving is one of the things that you can do to help with this kind of recoverability. Another thing is user guidance. So context-sensitive help, you know, that's where you have different kinds of help available depending on what the user is doing at that time. And tooltips, where you mouse over something, you see a little pop-up that tells you about that thing before you click on it. Those are users really like. We found that having context-sensitive help was something that people liked a lot. We also found that people really liked videos. So we had all of this really great help documentation in the form of web pages, and you just click, and you know, you see there's on every screen there's a set of help links that are specific for that particular screen. and you just click on them and it tells you exactly what you need to do, and you know, quite short. And we thought we'd try making some videos of some of those, even though a video is actually a much less useful way of documenting things because you have to sit and watch the whole thing. Whereas with a help page, you can just scan to the bit that you want. But people love them. So we just made a lot of very short videos and put them in. So you have to work with the users that you have. You need to provide meaningful error messages, so things like segmentation fault or null pointer exception, you know, that doesn't tell the user anything. And in many cases, it's not going to tell you very much either. So one of the things that you need to do is to make sure that, in terms of user guidance, is to make sure that the error messages that are displayed to the user make sense to them. So they're written from their point of view. And that is quite a bit harder than it sounds, because you have to have a good understanding of the way they're looking at the system to be able to do that. But it's also, just from a coding point of view, can be difficult to do. So if you've got a component that is dealing with part of the user interface, and so in that component, you know, the code that's in that component has some idea of what the user's trying to do at that point. So it could print out a sensible error message if it knew there was an error. But it uses a method from another component that does something that's a bit buried in the system, and that uses a method from another component, and so on, and eventually you get to, you know, a database call or something, and you get an error in the database call. So in order to print out a message that's sensible for the user, you have to make sure that exception gets handled back at the original object, because it's the only one that can give some sensible feedback to the user, which means that you have to make sure that handling of exceptions, it's not okay to just handle exceptions. You have to handle them in the right place, so that, because the component that's accessing the database, probably all it can say is, you know, database access failed, which is completely useless for the user. So I'm sure you've all seen incomprehensible error messages. Although I must say, in my experience, the error messages in software are better than they used to be, on the whole. You have to remember you've got a very diverse set of users. So something like 10% of males have red-green color blindness or to some extent. So, you know, a number of people in here have that. One of my sons has that. So if you design your user interface so that the red, you know, there's a difference between the meaning of red and green, which is pretty easy to do, then let's say you have a red tick on a green background, you know, some people aren't going to be able to see that. That's a very common one and a simple one, but there are a lot more complex disabilities to deal with. And there are quite a lot of legal obligations now that came in with the Equality Act in 2010, so fairly recent, particularly to do with websites, requirements on usability for people with disabilities. So if you're involved in website design, then you need to know about that. My impression is that a lot of websites are not particularly paying attention to that, but there's quite a lot of pressure to do so, particularly for bigger companies. Okay, so here's an example, and this is actually quite a recent example. If an application, suppose an application tries to save a file to a disk, the save fails because the user's disk quota has been exceeded, and so the application doesn't tell the user that there's been any problem. And actually, this came up in the third year staff student liaison committee just last week, people were complaining that, and you may have experienced it on DICE, that Firefox, if you download something, try to save it, but you're out of quota, then Firefox doesn't tell you. It just looks like it worked, but it didn't. So that violates a number of these guidelines. One approach to this would be to say, well, you know, this doesn't actually violate any guidelines. The stupid user should have known, you know, should have checked they had enough disk space. Or it's not it's the operating system's job to tell the user that there isn't enough space, not the application. But you see, both of those, well, obviously the first one is just not realistic at all. But even the second one, the user's dealing with the application, not the operating system at that point in time. So that's what has to tell them. So doesn't give, in this case, I mean, we can go through these. So user familiarity, it's not really a problem with that. Consistency, it's not really a problem with that. Minimal surprise, well, it's a problem for that because the user's going to be surprised, right? They thought they'd saved the file and it turns out it's not there. Recoverability, that's potentially an issue. They've maybe navigated away from or shut Firefox down or whatever it is before they discover that they haven't actually saved this thing. User guidance, it's not giving people the guidance that they need. So it's violating several of these criteria. And it's quite interesting that Firefox would do that because, you know, Firefox is fairly well engineered and it's got a fairly good user interface. So I'm surprised that it did that. So another important aspect of user interface design is task analysis. So that's knowing what users want to do with the system and in what order and what combination. And that sometimes is referred to as workflows. So, you know, what's the user's workflow? When they use this application, how do they sequence through it? And do you support the way they want to sequence through it? And this is something that we've in our electronic lab notebook is something that we've had to spend quite a bit of time in trying to understand. So, for example, if the application asks the user a question and they then have to go and search several other places to find the information, that's not particularly useful. So when you're in the design process, user stories and use cases are much more useful than traditional requirements because they're giving you some typical usage scenarios. They're giving you some of the workflows. And you don't want to play safe by providing access to everything from every page or every screen of the application because that can just be confusing. And it can be if an application does that, it could be just poor execution of the project. In other words, somewhere in the project, people knew what the users want to do and what the tasks are, but that didn't get through to the interface design team. It could be that. Or it could be that actually they don't have the knowledge of what the users need to do. And in that kind of situation, it's an indication you need to go back to the users and get an idea of what their workflows are. So I mentioned building a model of the world, and that's really the kind of the thing that draws all of these things together. So the user, so people are really good at pattern recognition. So they see patterns of things happening on the screen in front of them. And they build some sort of model of what this thing is doing. And they're going to build a model of how your application works. And when your application works in a way that goes against their model, they're going to be confused. So you want to try and keep the user's model and the reality, that is what your application is doing, in sync. And you've got some control over both. So you've got control over what the application's doing. And you can try to have some control over the user's model by presenting things in a clear way, and a consistent way, and so on. You can never, of course, be sure that they've really understood it. So user interaction, there are lots of different ways in which users can interact with an application. And it depends on the, you know, the task that's being executed and on what people like to do. So for example, drag and drop, you know, direct manipulation, like drag and drop, selecting from menus, filling in forms, command language, like in traditional Unix systems, or natural language, which is a front end to command languages, but now it's used increasingly in all sorts of applications, for example, in Siri, which I gather is quite effective as a natural language front end. So you can think of advantages and disadvantages for each of these. So think of drag and drop. Can you think of what's an advantage of drag and drop over, say, using a command line?
It's intuitive.
Sorry?
It's intuitive,
right. People can see exactly what they're doing. And what's a disadvantage?
Slower?
Sorry?
Someone drops something in the wrong place.
If they drop it in the wrong place. Yeah, they could do the wrong thing with the command language too. But I mean, you're both sort of right. It's the with a command language, you can do much more, you can do lots more things. Let's say you want to remove all the files that are, you know, JPEGs in a folder, right? It's easy with a command line command. And if you've got to do drag and drop, it's a bit harder, because at the very least you've got to order them by file extension, and then maybe you can pick them all up as one block if you're lucky. So that's just, and you can think of similar, similar issues to do with, for example, menus. Lots of people love menus, but what if you've got 10,000 different choices? How are you going to present that on the screen? Command languages, I think probably most of us like them, but they're not easy to use for most people. Natural language is a good example. I mean, what can you think of as what's an advantage of natural language? It's easy to pick up new users because they don't have to learn. They don't have to learn whatever the interface is. Yeah, that's one. Or if you need to do something else with your hands, then you can talk to the machine. That's another. What about disadvantages? Yeah, it's if you want to do something really precisely, natural language is probably not a very good way to specify it. At least the computer systems are not good enough to to understand us yet. Information presentation is a really interesting part of user interface design. The first thing is that the information that you present to the user and the way it's presented should be completely divorced from the way it's represented in the computer. So, you may store data in tables in a computer, but that doesn't mean that you want to show the user a table. So you can show it as text, graphs. You can show tables, pie charts, maps with overlays. So there are all sorts of different ways of presenting information, and there's a whole area of research and an understanding to do with the best way to present complex information to people. So continuously varying information is best presented in an analog way, not as numbers. You show a graph or something like that. And data visualization is a kind of sub-component of this that's important in scientific areas, well, in many areas now. And it means presenting typically large amounts of data in some sort of abstract way, sometimes with virtual reality navigation. One of the great authors in this area is Edward Tufte, who's written a series of four really beautiful books about information presentation, where they're beautiful because he shows examples of really fantastic information presentation. And I would recommend, if you're at all interested in this, I would recommend you just take a look at his website and some of the pictures from his books. They're quite expensive books to buy. They're sort of coffee table books. They're so beautiful. Color is an aspect of information presentation, and that's again another huge area. There are perceptual psychologists who spend their lives understanding how people perceive color, and some of that work has gone into the human user interface work. So Ben Schneiderman is an authority on this, and he's come up with a number of rules. So some of them are here: use few colors, no more than 4 or 5 per context, and no more than 7 in total. And it's interesting that maps to our short-term memory capacity. I'm not sure if there's a connection, but the numbers are similar. So color changes should signal something significant. And this is something that you'll find not just on user interfaces, but in presentations, like PowerPoint type presentations. People will sometimes do color changes, or they'll have one thing in one color, another thing in another color, just have a color change, and it doesn't mean anything. And it's really a bad idea. So you want to have a color code that's designed to help the users, not just because you want half a dozen colors on the screen. And you should color code consistently. So if red means error, then always use it for error. So in these kind of slides, I've used, in some places I use red means, this is something that I want you to pay attention to. In other places I've used blue, it means this is something that is showing you some of the structure of this slide. And these might not have been obvious to you, but I have at least been consistent about it. You want to be careful about color pairing. So, don't do that. And why do you think that's a bad idea?
The colors are pretty similar.
Does everyone think the colors are similar?
Low contrast.
Well. Yeah, it's interesting actually that it looks quite different on the screen than it does here. I see what you mean. That does look kind of low contrast, but on the screen, when I look at that, it looks like the red is kind of standing out at me. It's really kind of glaring. And that's because red and blue, you probably know this, red and blue are at the opposite ends of the spectrum. So the lens in your eye can't focus them both simultaneously. So it picks one, and the other one then looks further away or further back, depending on which way you do it. So you know, you have to be careful about that sort of thing. And of course, you have to be careful about colorblindness issues when it comes to color pairings. This is another important thing that people often get wrong. So you should only vary colors along one of the three dimensions, hue, saturation, and brightness. So hue is, you probably know all this, but hue is basically the color. Saturation is, you know, the percentage of white in it. And brightness is the, well, you know, it's how bright it is. And if you're going to vary the colors, like let's say you want a variation, you know, to represent some change, something that's changing, then you should only change one of these dimensions, because if you change more than one, people get confused. And you need to know the output technology. So this is another example. That, how do you like that green there on that screen? It's okay, right? But you try looking at it on a computer. You could download this later and, you know, take a look at it on your computer screen. It's actually pretty hard to read. So you need to know, like, you know, is it going to be on, in most cases, you're going to be developing for a computer screen, so you need to know. And that, you know, this is the kind of thing that would be readable in print, but and it's readable up on the overhead screen. And again, remember about colorblindness. So those are all aspects of interface design. But one of the things about interface design is it should be done iteratively, independently of, you know, which of these principles you're relying on, because you want to involve the users in making a judgment of have you got it right. So typically you design a prototype interface, you evaluate it with users, analyze the results, and then go through the cycle again. So that's just like our cycle of getting requirements, doing design, implementing, and rolling out to users, and then doing some redesign. So it's the same sort of thing that we've had with the software engineering process in general, specifically applied to user interfaces. Sometimes you might involve people from other fields. So for example, ethnographists go out and study the use of, you know, how people are working in a particular environment, and they can give you insights. And it's hard to do evaluation. So to do evaluation properly, what you're doing is a psychology experiment, pretty much, with a set of people. And there's a whole area of understanding about how to design good experiments so that you can make conclusions that are useful. So you can get professionals to help you with that, or you can read HCI books. And another way that this kind of evaluation is being done now is it's different. So Google runs experimental systems that will present to a certain percentage of users, say, a different set of query results, or differently ordered, or a slightly different interface. And if you've got, you know, hundreds of thousands or millions of users, you can do that. You can say, okay, for 1% of these users, we're gonna present them with, you know, a new component or a slightly different version of a component on the component on the screen, and we'll see where they click. And because you're running a web interface rather than an application on a desktop, you can monitor what people do with that information. So you can actually, while people are using the system, Google and lots of companies I think are doing this now, can evaluate whether one aspect of an interface is more effective than another aspect. And that's where the kind of data that comes back from that Instead of using sort of experimental design methods to decide how to deal with that data, you can use machine learning methods to evaluate it and to draw conclusions from it. So this is an evolving area. So this is an exercise for you to do next time you use some sort of fairly complex piece of software, particularly something that you haven't used much before. You know, look at its interface carefully, and think about, you know, how much better could you do if the principles that we've talked about here were used. Or you could look at the design of an API that, you know, if the interface to a class that should be reusable, what makes it good or bad? It's the same sort of concept. Okay, so the last aspect of this, let's see, where are we time-wise? Well, I'll just start at the beginning of it and then we'll finish it off next time. So users do have responsibilities, and they should be using due care and attention. If they don't understand what's going on, they should read the manual, and they should report bugs sensibly. So all of these things are things that users should do. Very often they don't do them, you have to try and pay attention to that. But the last one of those, reporting bugs sensibly, is something that you can make sure you do when you're the user. So next time I'll go through just a little bit about bug reporting before we go on to the other content. Okay, good. Thank you.
Oh, there's no glasses there.